From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The House passes English only. We'll talk with Juan Gonzalez in Puerto Rico. A Latino private is beaten up by military police at Fort Bragg. His attorney is charging a cover-up.
The Army says that this guy didn't have a swastika. What it was an ancient Indian symbol. And, of course, anyone knows the Nazis appropriated the swastika, which, by the way, is a Hindu word from Indian philosophy. So that is just preposterous to think that some 21-year-old MP is going to be a follower of an ancient Indian religion, rather than much more likely that he's a follower of Adolf Hitler.
A wrap-up from Mexico on the Zapatistas International Conference on Democracy, and a look at the difficulties facing alternative parties trying to get on the ballot throughout the United States. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. The Clinton administration is threatening to veto a bill that would require all federal business to be conducted in English. The measure was passed by the House yesterday by a vote of 259 to 169, but not before an emotional debate. House Speaker Newt Gingrich said English is the tie that binds the country together, and mastery of the language is critical for immigrants who expect to do well. But Democrats denounced the bill as divisive, anti-immigrant, and disrespectful of minorities. Billy Dale, who was fired as head of the White House Travel Office, is going to work for Bob Dole's presidential campaign, making flight arrangements during his general election battle with President Clinton. The Dole campaign said Dale will start the job after Dole is nominated at the Republican National Convention, which takes place August 12th to 15th in San Diego. And with several top campaign advisors urging him to rush out a tax-cutting economic plan before the Republican National Convention, Bob Dole picked up the phone to ask California Governor Pete Wilson for his thoughts. Go slow, Wilson cautioned. Then there is the search for a running mate. Senator Olympia Snow of Maine favors a supporter of abortion rights and laments that there are no women on Dole's prospect list. Pat Buchanan, on the other hand, warns if we get a pro-choice Rockefeller Republican as vice president, there will be no peace in the valley. And you're listening to Democracy Now! We're joined now by Juan Gonzalez, who is at a Puerto Rican journalist conference in Puerto Rico. And the main subject there is exactly what happened last night. Juan, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks, Amy. And, the island of Puerto Rico has been reeling this week from several things that have occurred in Washington. The latest, of course, is the conference committee agreement on the English only legislation, which in Puerto Rico especially would have incredible repercussions, because it would basically require all activities of federal agencies in Puerto Rico to be conducted solely in English. For instance, there are thousands of Social Security recipients, people in public housing projects run by HUD, veterans who get services from the Veterans Administration, who live here in Puerto Rico, obviously speak Spanish as their principal and many for their sole language, and now will be receiving, as a result of this legislation, if it's signed by the president, will be receiving all communication only in English. And in essence, all the federal agencies would be prohibited from sending out anything in the English language or having any written materials, booklets, or whatever in the English language. So here, for all of the federal agencies, it would create enormous problems. People would not be prohibited from speaking Spanish to people who come into federal offices, but they could not give them any written material in any language other than English. It would also create enormous problems by eliminating the bilingual ballot, because obviously all elections in Puerto Rico are conducted and all election material is in Spanish. There is one federal post on the island, which is the post of resident commissioner, Carlos Romero Barceló, whom we have had on Democracy Now! Different on occasion, would, for instance, have to send out all of his mailings to his constituents from Washington only in English. So suddenly hundreds of thousands of Puerto Ricans whom he represents in Washington would be getting mailings, not in Spanish about what are the activities in Congress, but only in English. So, and his election, or the which is coming up now in November, but future elections for resident commissioner would have to be separated from the regular Puerto Rican elections, because all the material there would have to be in English, whereas most of the material and the voting processes for all the other posts on the island are in Spanish. So it would create enormous problems even in the conduct of the vote for resident commissioner. So this has got the whole island in an uproar, with the political parties not knowing exactly how they're going to deal with this. In addition, there is what's on the horizon, which will be when Congress comes back from its Labor Day recess and after the conventions. There is the bill for a new plebiscite in Puerto Rico on the status issue, the Young Bill, which will be considered by Congress. And as part of that bill, Representative Gerald Solomon, New York, the Republican representative from New York, is attempting to require that if Puerto Rico does elect a majority for statehood, if the island were to become the 51st state, that its official language would also have to, of all the local agencies on the island, would have to be in English, and that the public school instruction would have to switch from its current Spanish as the main language of instruction to English. So this is an even greater transformation or attempt to impose the English language on 3.7 million Puerto Ricans, the vast majority of whom Spanish is still not only the dominant language, but for many the only language.
Juan, what do you think is motivating this vote? Of course, the Republicans are behind it. Newt Gingrich said, as I read earlier, that it's the tie that binds the country together, and mastery of the language is critical for immigrants. Do you think he's talking about Puerto Rico as well when he talks like that?
Well, clearly, I think that there are some in the many Republicans, especially conservative Republicans, who have never really accepted or felt comfortable with the fact that Puerto Rico and Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens, and to some extent, I think they correctly perceive that there is a separate language and culture and nation that exists in Puerto Rico, and they've never been comfortable with the relationship, the colonial relationship that exists in Puerto Rico, not because the United States dominates and controls the island, but because the island is so different and distinct from the rest of the United States. So I think that that this is, in essence, Congress is sending a message to Puerto Rico, and I think that gradually to have effect, which is that we don't want you. We don't want you as part of the American family, and that this is creating enormous problems, because the fastest-growing movement in Puerto Rico is the statehood movement. And the statehood party here has always told its followers that Puerto Rico would be able to become a state while retaining its own language and culture. In effect, they called it the Creole state. It's questionable whether hundreds of thousands of Puerto Ricans who have supported statehood would accept a statehood whereby they'd have to give up their language and culture. And so I think this is creating enormous problems for the statehood movement.
Juan, talking about the statehood movement and the vote on statehood versus independence versus maintaining the Commonwealth status, there has been some politicking going on the island of Puerto Rico that is would influence voting here. Can you talk about the controversy over the Puerto Rican governor and what he's saying to Congress members like Nidia Velasquez of New York and Luis Gutierrez of Chicago, right, Illinois?
Oh, yes, no, that's important. Before, but in the context, I've got to give you the context, which is that the other major battle that has occurred, and which also Congress decided on this weekend, which is a source of the conflict between the governor of Puerto Rico and Nidia Velasquez and Luis Gutierrez, is that earlier in the week, as part of the minimum wage bill that was Congress finally agreed on eliminating the Section 936 tax credits for Puerto Rico, which in essence meant that the corporate welfare that has existed here for decades, the special tax loopholes that American corporations use to shelter their income was eliminated, because that money was used instead to help provide tax relief for small businesses who would now have to begin paying the federal minimum wage. As a result, the key economic centerpiece of Puerto Rico's industrialization has been eliminated. It's going to be phased out over 10 years. And the attempts of the statehood party, which supported that elimination, because they saw that as a means of maintaining the Commonwealth status. The result has been now that the statehood party was able to get the elimination of 936, but they were trying to substitute for it what they called a wage credit, where American companies who set up in Puerto Rico and employed X number of workers would get a credit for the wages that they paid each of those workers. Well, Congress didn't give them that. As a result now, there is a tremendous fear that many American companies that are here and providing jobs only because of Section 936 will now leave the island. And the unemployment rate is already about 18%, fluctuates between 15 and 18% here, so that this may create greater unemployment, more exodus of Puerto Ricans to the United States. And what it has shown is that neither the statehood party nor the Commonwealth Party, the two major parties, have any influence in Congress. Congress just decides what it wants to do based on its own needs, not on the needs of the Puerto Rican people. So the 1-2 punch this week of, on the one hand, eliminating 936 and providing no industrial incentive program for Puerto Rico, and then the English-only bill has the island reeling. Now, the battle between Rosselló as the governor and Nidia Velázquez and Gutiérrez as congressman in the U.S. was over 936, that Nidia and Luis Gutiérrez were very vocal and active in attempting to keep 936, the tax exemption program, in place, whereas the governor of Puerto Rico was very vocally opposing it and basically telling them, hey, what are you doing butting into the internal affairs of the island of Puerto Rico? Why don't you all stay dealing with your problems with the Puerto Ricans in New York and Chicago and leave the problems of the island to those of us who were elected? And as a result, a nasty exchange of letters developed, and the governor, especially Barceló, the resident commissioner, who is allied with the governor, has been threatening to actually support candidates in New York and Chicago to run against Nidia Velázquez and Luis Gutiérrez. This, in turn, got all the rest of the Latino elected officials, Puerto Rican elected officials, especially in New York and New Jersey, angry and upset, and they sent off a letter to the governor saying, what are you doing running candidates against us? And he said, well, if they hadn't been butting into our affairs in Puerto Rico, we wouldn't feel that we had to take such drastic steps.
We're talking to Juan Gonzalez, my co-host, usually reporting from New York, but now he's in Puerto Rico for the Puerto Rican Journalists Conference that is taking place this week, where also the issue of English only has been a major issue. Juan, you are writing a book. You're just finishing a book on Latinos in America. How many Puerto Ricans are on the mainland as opposed to in Puerto Rico?
There are approximately, as of the last census, which of course that now is quite dated, but there are about 2 points. There were about 2.6 to 2.7 million Puerto Ricans in 1990 in the U.S. and about 3.6 to 3.7 million in the island. So it was approaching, even in 1990, nearly one half of all the Puerto Ricans. Huh. Were in the United States.
And where are they concentrated? I know here in New York, of course.
Well, yeah, obviously New York is the largest concentration. Chicago was the second largest concentration. And But throughout the East Coast, I mean, most of the major cities in Connecticut have a good 25% to 30% of their populations are Latino, mostly Puerto Rican, and Hartford, Bridgeport, New Haven.
Now, let me ask you, yesterday the Mexican legislature voted to allow Mexicans in the United States to vote in their elections and on issues in Mexico, and that means millions of Mexicans in the United States and outside of Mexico in general. What about Puerto Ricans in the mainland, on the mainland? United States. What are your voting rights in Puerto Rico?
They are none. I mean, unless you have a residence here, and there are some people who actually maintain a residence here and who live in the U.S., but unless you have residence here, you cannot participate in any local elections. There was a big debate when the last referendum was held in 1993, that because a referendum over status is quite different from a normal local election to select candidates for office, that all Puerto Ricans, wherever they were, whether they were in Spain or in Venezuela or in New York or Florida, should have the right to participate in a status referendum on the future of the island. And there has been precedence for that in previous United Nations referendums or status plebiscites, but that was rejected by the political parties here, who were fearful that there were so many Puerto Ricans outside of the island that in essence that people outside the island might have a decisive impact on the result, and so that was rejected, and so that basically, whether it's in a status referendum or whether it's in a regular election, people outside the island can't vote.
Juan, go ahead.
Yeah, no, and I think that but the reality is that there's a tremendous amount of involvement and cross-fertilization, I would say, between politicians. The island politicians come here every year and hold joint conferences with the local leaders, the mayors, and the senators and legislators from the island regularly travel to the United States. So there is that kind of interchange, but not at the level of the average voter.
Juan, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Also, this last note that we just got over our AP machine, and that is that the Cuban journalists who were invited to address the Puerto Rican journalists at the Puerto Rican Journalist Conference were denied visas by the State Department. They were not allowed to speak. United States State Department said it's because of Cuba's crackdown on independent journalists in Cuba, and it seems to have become an issue in Puerto Rico among the Puerto Rican Journalists Association. The leadership there, they put out a fax that we got decrying what the State Department is doing, preventing free speech, etc.
You know, that's created quite a furor here. You see, this whole week is the week of Puerto Rican journalists, and every TV station, the radio have events and activities, and there are numerous conferences. It's quite unlike the United States here, but there's a great attention paid to the week of Puerto Rican journalists here, and so that the U.S. government's denial of visas to these two Cuban journalists, because there are about 10 of us from the United States, Latino journalists who were invited to come down, that has created quite a bit of bad feeling.
Juan Gonzalez, thanks for joining us. I look forward to seeing you here on the mainland when you come back. And, of course, Juan Gonzalez will be joining us in San Diego next week when we bring you our two-hour daily coverage from the Republican Convention. Juan, thanks for being with us.
Okay, thank you.
And you're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, we're going to be taking a look at the international conference held by the Zapatistas in the southern state of Chiapas, which is wrapping up today. Then we're going to look at racism in the military, particularly at Fort Bragg and a racist attack that occurred last weekend. Finally, we'll be looking at ballot access laws in this country. This is Democracy Now! Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Amy Goodman, and you're listening to Democracy Now!, a program where we look at international pro-democracy movements as well as such movements here in the United States. An international gathering is being called by the Zapatistas, and it's wrapping up today in Chiapas. Activists from around the world, including hundreds from the United States, have traveled to the Mexican jungle to discuss the situation of indigenous people and to strategize how to fight neoliberal economic policies that concentrate wealth in the hands of a few and perpetuate and exacerbate poverty among the majority in the developing world. We're joined now by Pacifica's Jana Schroeder, who is in the southern state of Chiapas, one of the poorest in Mexico. She's just come out of the jungle and is in San Cristobal de las Casas to talk to us. Jana, can you tell us what has happened over the last week of this international gathering?
Well, people from over 40 countries responded to an invitation by the indigenous Zapatistas in Chiapas, Mexico, to come to the Lacandona jungle and get together and talk about things. And what the topic is how to change global economic policies. The people have been divided into five groups that went to five different communities, some of which are quite remote, and talked about different topics. And each participant could choose the topic that interested them most. And those five topics were basically political issues, economic, social, cultural, and indigenous issues. So they spent 3 days. People could bring their own ideas, their proposals to present, and there was discussion, and the ideas to come to agreements. And I think the feeling on most people's part is not just to come to agreements about what they think, but also what they're going to do.
Jana, who are these people? How many people showed up from around the world, and where are they from? What countries and what groups?
But the number seems to be about at 3,000. They do come from 40 different countries. Those countries, I would say, there's a lot of representation from European countries, especially France and Italy, also Germany, but as well Greece, England, Portugal, and others. Then there's also a strong representation from Central American countries, the Caribbean islands, South American countries. From the United States, I tried to get a figure on just how many folks are here from the United States. The figure has varied, but it seems to be around 200 people. In terms of who they are, like what kind of folks are these, they're certainly progressive folks. We could define them as progressive folks, left-leaning folks, but certainly a broad range within that. I don't think we'd want to define it in too limiting of a way. There's artists here, women's groups, a lot of workers and unionists. Some folks say you can find the punks here, you can find separatist groups, anarchists, lots of different folks. Interestingly, the Zapatistas really broadened up who this is for, and they talk a lot about plurality. They say it straight out. This is for everyone. For example, gay and lesbian issues have been included. Ecological concerns have been included.
How did the Zapatistas say that international solidarity will help the cause of the Mayan Indians, the Zapatistas in southern Mexico?
Well, I asked that question of Comandante David. He's one of the indigenous leaders who has been participating in the negotiating. And he said, let me play that for you so you can hear what he said.
Y va a aumentar pues la participación de más personas todavía al ver que hay mucha gente de todo el mundo.
What he said is that they hope very much that this event and others like it do increase the international support that they have, that when the word gets around, more and more people are going to realize that their struggle is legitimate, and that is very important for them having any kind of success at the negotiating table, that they hope this will give them a stronger position at the negotiating table, because they feel that the government isn't going to move from its position unless there is some kind of pressure.
When you and I were covering the first peace talks between the Zapatistas and the Mexican government that took place in San Cristobal de las Casas a few months after the Zapatista uprising, this was in February of 1994, one of the things that was being discussed was that it's not just the issue of Mayan Indians that were on the table and how NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, was further marginalizing and impoverishing the Mayan Indians, but the whole issue of democracy in Mexico is on the table. Now, according to the Associated Press, Mexico's House of Representatives has unanimously approved sweeping electoral reforms, paving the way for tougher challenges to the party that has held a lock on power for the last 67 years. It was a unanimous vote that includes a provision to let Mexicans in the United States and elsewhere vote in Mexican elections. Although critics are saying most of Mexico's electoral reforms have been cosmetic, enabling PRI to remain in power, parties are hoping that this year's changes turn out to be more substantive. Would you say this has come from pressure from the Zapatistas, or is it merely cosmetic and it's not even worth mentioning?
Well, I think the pressure's come from a lot of places, and in terms of for the reforms that have just been approved. Chiapas and the Zapatistas may be one of the pressures, but by no means is it the only pressure. I think people are very cautious about expecting a great deal from those reforms, and they want to see in the concrete, in actions, the changes.
On Monday, we had a report from the Sao Paulo Conference of the Progressive Movements around Latin America from San Salvador. And on the same day, Larry Roeder of the New York Times did a very cynical piece on this gathering in San Salvador of the Progressive Movements. And one of the things he said is they use the same old alibis and excuses, blaming the World Bank, the IMF, the CIA, for the continued problems in Latin America. Do you think of these as looking for excuses, or that there are these very real issues, the real causes of poverty in Mexico?
One of the celebrities that's attending the event, along with just a lot of regular folks, is Alain Touraine, a well-known French writer. And one of the comments that he made this week is that in order to fight a global system of power, you need a global system of opposition. And what other folks are saying is that what the so-called globalization of the world's economy isn't so global because it leaves a lot of people out. Subcomandante Marcos specifically talked to that issue. I can play you a little bit of his tape. What he said is that what we need to do, what the Zapatistas want to do, is create a world where everyone fits. And he talks about that together, everyone needs to get together and create a new path.
Sabemos que para lo que sigue tenemos que escuchar otras voces y necesitamos que esas otras voces, se escuchen entre ellas.
And a lot of people talked about that. They're looking for new definitions, new ways of new methods of resistance, new forms of unionism, for example, to get beyond old definitions. People talk about being tired of the old ideologies. And that what the Zapatistas have to say is really quite refreshing. They use terms like humanity, working for humanity. They talk about dignity and justice. And for one reason or another, that seems to appeal to people right now.
Any discussion of the U.S. presidential elections this year, or are they irrelevant to what's going on right now in Mexico, in one of the poorest areas of Mexico?
The people I talk to seem to be in agreement that the U.S. elections don't seem very important, really. They don't think it matters much who wins. They said that they didn't see really any option available to U.S. voters, that whether Dole or Clinton wins. In terms of foreign policy, it looks like things will be quite the same. And in general, people are looking for change beyond elections. They're looking for different ways of organizing. And what I think a lot of people are looking for here in Chiapas is how to make connections internationally. And they talk about the use of Internet. There was a lot of talk about that's the best way they're going to have to communicate in a way that hasn't been possible in the past, to make those international connections and to not only talk about things, but also take action, coordinated action.
As we wrap up, maybe we should go back to the beginning, and that is, tell us who Zapata was, the man that the Zapatistas have named themselves after.
The Zapatistas named themselves after the revolutionary hero from the early part of the century in Mexico, whose name was Zapata. And he was known for not selling out, for being true to his word, for doing exactly what he said he was going to do. And it's interesting, they named themselves after that hero from the early part of this century. Now they say the Zapatismo, as we say in Spanish, of 1993, of 1994 was one thing, and maybe it's changing. And they're even going so far as to say that there may be some sort of new Zapatismo that is still yet to be defined, that goes beyond Chiapas, beyond Mexico, and at the
Jan Schroeder, thank you very much for coming out of the jungle in Chiapas and joining us from San Cristobal de las Casas. You're listening to Democracy Now! Racism has reared its head again at Fort Bragg in North Carolina. On Saturday, July 20th, two off-duty military police savagely beat a young Latino officer and two of his white colleagues. And just this week, swastikas again showed up on the base. Todd Ensign is joining us now. He's the director of Citizen Soldier, a GI rights advocacy group here in New York City. It's a group that closely monitors extremism in the U.S. military. Todd, you were representing the young private who was beaten up. Can you tell us what happened last weekend?
Yes, on the night of July 20th, three young privates, one of whom was Hispanic, were attacked on the base at Fort Bragg by two military policemen. The reason we believe it's racially based was that the policeman asked the Hispanic fellow if he was Mexican, and then later it was learned after the beating that one of the two MPs had a swastika tattoo on his body.
Explain what MPs are.
Well, military policemen, MPs, are, the police force of an Army base. These fellows apparently were off duty, but as soon as the incident went down and these kids were put in the hospital, the cover-up began at Fort Bragg, and the military police commanders took over the investigation, and they still are in charge of investigating their own agents.
How did the MPs happen on these young people?
These three young guys had just completed jump school at Fort Benning. They had just arrived at Bragg, and they went out for an evening, went to a couple bars in the Fayetteville area. They were trying to get a ride back to the base with a taxi company. These two guys drove up and said, we'll take you. As I say, they then interrogated the one guy about what his ethnicity was, and then when they got to the base, as they got out of the car, they jumped them and beat two of them so badly they had to have stitches and medical care.
You say the cover-up began when they went into the hospital. Explain what kind of information has come out now.
Well, one thing that really concerns us at Citizen Soldier is that there was no examination by a doctor, which these guys both had head injuries. They could have been quite serious. One guy had been knocked unconscious. Yet no one at the Womack Medical Centers assigned them to see a doctor. My view of that would be that they're trying to minimize and downplay this, make it just look like a Friday night beer brawl somewhere.
What do you want to see happen?
Well, what really has to happen is the Secretary of Army, Togo West, and his people, they're the ones that did, you remember, back in March, they published a study on extremist activity. They said there was minimal evidence of it around the country. They've got to get involved here. They've got to push aside the command. The command down there cannot be trusted. There is obviously a fairly large element of skinheads or extremists on that base. The command doesn't know how to deal with them, and Secretary West has got to get involved. And, of course, Congress needs to become involved.
In a piece that was in the Fayetteville Observer Times this past Saturday, a senior Army official who asked not to be identified said it's premature to say that the fight was related to extremist activity at Fort Bragg. He says it's not fair to the command, but more importantly, it's not fair to the 45,000 soldiers who work hard, train hard, and excel every day to make this assumption. And he's responding to your charges.
Exactly. It's preposterous. I mean, the fact is, these three young guys all heard the guy asking them about the kid's ethnicity. They also all heard the other MPs tell them that this guy had a swastika. To show how deep the cover-up goes, now in that same story, the Army says that this guy didn't have a swastika. What it was an ancient Indian symbol. And, of course, anyone knows the Nazis appropriated the swastika, which, by the way, is a Hindu word, from the Indian philosophy. So that is just preposterous to think that some 21-year-old MP is going to be a follower of an ancient Indian religion, rather than much more likely that he's a follower of Adolf Hitler.
Now, they fled the scene after they did the beating?
They fled, and then they were apprehended because they had happened to mention these fellows what unit they were in.
What's happened to the young men who have come to Fort Bragg and were beaten up? Are they still in the hospital?
Well, what often happens with victims of racial prejudice, they are, in a way, painted somehow as the miscreants. In fact, one of them has already been dumped from the military with an entry-level separation. The fellow I'm representing, Dominic Lund, who's from the Bronx, he is being processed now for an entry-level separation.
What is entry-level separation?
Well, it's
mean?
A type of administrative discharge that takes place in the early phases of your military tour, so that they characterize your service as deficient, that you didn't meet military standards. It's a negative thing, even though it's not really a bad discharge. We believe that Dominic and the others should all have honorable discharges, but the military, as I say, they're persisting in branding these guys as somehow screw-ups.
But do they want to leave at all?
Two of them are quite frightened. They're fearful. One of the MPs actually came into the treatment room and was rubbing his hand where the people had been hurt, almost mocking their injuries. So there is an atmosphere down there that these groups are out of control.
Well, let's talk about that. I went to the congressional hearings a few weeks ago with Toga West, the Secretary of the Army, also the Secretary of the Air Force, the Secretary of the Navy, and they were talking about racist activity within the military, and they were saying that, you know, they're studying it and they think that they have a handle on it. What do you think of that?
Well, I don't believe it's true. Fort Bragg is particularly prone to this kind of thing because it is the home of very, shall we say, aggressive combat units. That's the 82nd Airborne and Special Forces, or the Green Berets. These are very aggressive combat units. They have a high level of, shall we say, morale and esprit. They jump out of planes and kill people, and their job is to go anywhere in the world on 18 hours notice. So I actually believe that the military likes to keep these men at a fairly high pitch. I'm not saying they encourage racism, but they like these people to feel we're the toughest of the toughest and we'll kick your butt if we want to. And that's the military encourages and fosters that attitude. And then, of course, when you mix that in with some good old-fashioned American racism, you get a pretty nasty brew.
I read your piece in Covert Action that you did on racism and right-wing activity in the military. You talked about how the Canadians actually won't even send their soldiers to Fort Bragg to train because of what's going on there.
Well, yes, the Canadian Airborne Regiment was training regularly at Fort Bragg, and when they would come back to Canada, they would actually bring Confederate flags with them in this sort of regalia, which you see a lot of at Fort Bragg, by the way. These guys had gone to Somalia as part of the Somali operation, the Canadians, that is, and they had killed five or six Somalian civilians at different times for violations like coming onto their base or maybe suspecting them of stealing something. So the theory here that I would propose is that Fort Bragg and the Special Forces School is really a center, a worldwide center. Now, they have troops there now from the Ukraine, Australia, Austria, all over the world, coming there to get the training of the best of the best, so to speak. And these guys, I think, come away from there with this really macho, dangerous, and sometimes racist mentality that then goes back and infests other countries.
What do you think are the most startling results of the Toga West report on racism, which, by the way, you felt wasn't bad?
Well, it wasn't bad in the sense that they did go out and talk to people. Where I think they missed the boat was they didn't really look at their own data. When they interviewed 17,000 troops who were confidential interviews, I should say surveyed, they found that 11% of them knew somebody who they considered to be an extremist in one of their units. 17% of them had seen extremist literature, and 3.5% of them had been approached for recruitment by an extremist organization. I believe those are alarming figures. We're talking about an army of 500,000 people. You're talking about 30,000 or 40,000 people.
So what do you think has to be done in the entire military to deal with this right-wing activity?
Well, the deeper problem, of course, is I argue in that article, the institutionalized racism. Conditions in the military are growing worse. Even Toga West in that report says that there's an alarming trend towards all-white units in the special forces and in the combat arms, and they say this could be a problem because it tends to reinforce and fuel certain racist attitudes that are already there. So one thing you'd have to do is see that the army is balanced out, that people are not allowed to form these little all-white pockets within these dangerous combat groups. And the other thing you'd have to do is start applying the law and assignment and promotion fairly so that blacks are not left out or suffer as second-class citizens within the military. That's the deeper problem and, of course, a harder problem to confront.
So right now, what you're calling for in the Lund case is an outside probe?
We're calling for those three young men, of course, to be given honorable discharges, and then for Secretary West to take over the investigation down there. We've also collaterally asked for Janet Reno, Attorney General, to come in and see, through her local U.S. attorney, see if there are crimes, hate crimes, which could be prosecuted under federal law. Because the military in this case, it's funny, usually the military is very aggressive about prosecuting people. People go to jail for long periods of time for trivial offenses. But what we've got here is a very great reluctance because what's happening, Amy, is careers are on the line. If some colonel or some major is seen here as being a leader of a group where there are people convicted of hate crimes, that person's got trouble for the future.
At the congressional hearing where the secretaries of the Army, Navy, and Air Force were, they basically said, yes, racism is a problem, this right-wing activity is a problem, but it's just simply a reflection of what's happening in society. I mean, the military will be no different.
Well, there's two things that are wrong about that. One is that the military is a highly armed and dangerous outfit. These are people that use M60 machine guns that fire hundreds of bullets a minute. They're trained in explosives. They're trained in demolition. So it's a little different order of things than talking about a bunch of pot-bellied bowlers out in Ohio that form some militia group. Secondly, the military has much more control over its membership. They can set in policy. They can set into place policies and rules which can be much more effectively enforced. So they don't have the same argument, you know, that some politician here in New York has, that these cops are out of control because, well, you can't really control them. They're out at night in dangerous zones of the city. The Army has a lot of control over the people, so they could be doing much more than they're doing. One final thing. I'm not arguing that GI's rights should be circumscribed or that their First Amendment rights should be cut back further. That's not part of our goal here. But we're talking about criminal activity where people feel justified in going out and beating the hell out of somebody because they're a Cuban or because they're a black person.
Todd Ensign, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Todd is director of Citizen Soldier, a group that closely monitors extremism in the U.S. military. It's a GI rights advocacy group here in New York. Its number is 212-679-2250. That's 212-679-2250. You're listening to Democracy Now! Coming up, we look at ballot access. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Richard Lamb doesn't have a voter list, he doesn't have millions of dollars to spend, and he doesn't have a debate commitment from his Reform Party presidential rival, Ross Perot. What he does have is a homepage on the World Wide Web, a broadcast-ready message, and Lamb insists a chance to win. One of the issues the Reform Party and other third parties have that to deal with is ballot access. The 96 election year has seen an unprecedented amount of alternative political party activity, with at least half a dozen parties running presidential candidates. But depending on where you live, you won't be able to vote for most of those candidates because of restrictive ballot rules. Richard Winger edits a newsletter about ballot access called Ballot Access News. He spoke recently with Pacifica's National Affairs correspondent Larry Bensky about the difficulties of alternative parties getting on the ballot in various states.
Richard Winger, the name of this program is Democracy Now!, and the first question I want to ask you maybe should be the last question in the interview. If we had a true democracy, would it be necessary to have a publication like Ballot Access News? Wouldn't things be so simple, transparent, and regular that there would just be a way to get on the ballot? That would be it.
Absolutely. I'd love to go out of business, and I would go out of business if that happened.
But you're nowhere near out of business, as I can tell from reading your paper.
Yeah, I'm afraid we've even been going backwards lately.
In what way?
Well, I was just noticing this morning the petition deadline to get a third-party presidential candidate on the ballot in 1996 is substantially earlier in 8 states than it was in 1992.
Meaning that who's it going to be difficult for?
Well, it certainly hurt Ralph Nader in Arizona. The old law, which was in effect in Arizona in 1992 and for decades past, permitted the petition to be turned in September. Now it's June, and they didn't make it. They're suing to overturn the deadline in court. I hope they win, but who knows?
Now, let's just start on the presidential level since you mentioned Ralph Nader, although ballot access is, of course, an issue down to much lower municipal levels. But let's start on the presidential level and talk about it. There are some people who seem to manage to get on the ballot pretty regularly, the Libertarian Party, for example, and most recently the Natural Law Party. These are parties that don't draw a lot of voters. They don't seem to have a lot of members. And we at Pacifica, for example, on election night, people are always calling me up the day after and saying, you didn't report the vote of the Green Party. You didn't report the vote of the Libertarian. I say, well, they don't report it to us. I have no way of finding out till weeks later. But these parties manage to get on the ballot pretty widely. How do they do it?
Well, first of all, it's important to note that the legislatures have made it easier to get on the ballot for third-party presidential candidates than for other office. They've done that deliberately because no state wants to be embarrassed by having somebody running for president who's really popular fail to get on the ballot in their state. Somebody like Ross Perot, if he only got on the ballot in 49 states, people would have been really upset with the 50th state. So they deliberately make it easier to get on for president than for other office. So when you say the Libertarian Party generally gets on the ballot, it's a struggle, but it can get on for president because that's easier. But no third party has been able to get on the ballot for even half the districts in Congress since 1920. But getting back to your question, the Libertarian Party and the Natural Law Party have some ability to raise money, and they use that money to hire people to circulate petitions. You know, I'm sure plenty of your listeners have circulated petitions. Some people like it, but most people think it's miserable work.
Well, and most people are paid to do it these days. I mean, here in California, for example, if you want to get, depending if it's a constitutional amendment or an initiative on the ballot, you have to get, 600,000 or 900,000 signatures. It's considered extraordinary if a citizens group is able to gather even half that many with volunteers. The rest always have to be paid for, and the going rate, I gather, has gone up from used to be a quarter a signature, then 75 cents. Now some people are paying $1.50.
There's been states this year where it's been up to $3.
$3 a signature.
That's when there wasn't much time left and there was a lot of competition.
How do I get there? That's a lot more. That's a lot more than I earn. Let's see, you get yourself 50 signatures an hour, you're doing pretty well.
That's right. It's a whole career. Some people, that's all they do in life.
Is get signatures for ballot initiatives or for candidates
mm-hmm.
to get on.
They travel around the country.
Okay, now let's take the Natural Law Party, for example, since I happen to mention them. This is a party that, frankly, I hadn't heard of until the last election at all. And then I started looking at some election returns where they got a smidgen of results in some local races, which actually were almost determinative, I believe, and maybe they were determinative in some states in the Northeast. How did they begin coming from nowhere and now get on the ballot in so many places?
Well, the Natural Law Party's pretty good at raising money. They it may be a new party, but there's an old organization there. The old organization is the loose network of people who've been interested in the Transcendental Meditation movement. So they have that network to draw on.
And you keep coming back to money again and again, as the electoral system, of course, as we mentioned so often, is based on who can pay for what. What does it cost as a minimal, would you say? Have you ever figured this out? For say I wanted to run Richard Winger for president, how much would it cost me as a minimum to get on the ballot in all 50 states?
If you were really crafty and started collecting signatures 2 years before the election, which is quite possible in some states, I think it could be done for about $1,200,000. What adds to the expense terribly is when people wait until the last minute to do it.
But, of course, if you're Ross Perot and money is no object, then it doesn't matter when you wait till.
Well, there's even some ballot access laws that are too much for Ross Perot.
Such as?
Florida. Florida requires 3% of the total number of registered voters to get a full party in the ballot. And it would have been to his advantage to have done that petition. It was 196,000, but even he looked at it and felt he couldn't get it done. Nobody's done that petition in 20 years.
So Ross Perot or whoever the Reform Party nominates is not going to be on the ballot in Florida?
That's an interesting question. There's a separate procedure in Florida for a presidential candidate only to be on the ballot, which is only 65,000 signatures. But the name of the candidate has to be on the petition. And Florida says that cannot be changed later. So Perot's name is on the Reform Party presidential petition in Florida.
So much for President Lamb.
Exactly. But I must point out they're in federal court now, and I'm hoping that lawsuit will be won and Florida will be told that they have to permit some flexibility.
Talk for a minute about, if you would, about what you've found that seems to you unusual in ballot access. As you talked about Florida a little bit a moment ago, I know from reading a few issues of your newsletter that there are things that go on in this country that are really off the charts as far as trying to deny people access to the tools of democracy. What are some of them?
I think the thing that surprises me and disappoints me the most is how unwilling our federal judges are to strike down laws which to me seem obviously discriminatory and obviously violative of the First Amendment. The biggest disappointment I've had was in 1992 when the U.S. Supreme Court ignored 100 years of precedent and said there is no constitutional right for the voter to vote for the candidate of his or her choice. Specifically, they upheld Hawaii's ban on write-in voting. Now, people might think, oh, write-in voting, that's not important, but it's surprisingly important. On the average, somebody gets elected to a state legislature every 2 years by write-ins. We've had 6 congressional victories by write-ins. And even internationally, the write-ins—
In the whole history of the Republic or recently?
Well, in the 20th century.
In the 20th century.
Anyway, for 100 years, 20 different state Supreme Courts had said that the voter has an intrinsic right to vote for whomever he or she wishes to vote for and had routinely struck down bans on write-in voting. There were only 5 states that banned them. The U.S. Supreme Court upheld Hawaii's ban on write-in voting by a vote of 6-3 and didn't even acknowledge any of the precedents. I could go on to other particular little examples.
Give us another particular little example on a local level where it's difficult. I know our listeners in New York, for example, are familiar with the extremely difficult nature of getting on the ballot there or even running in a primary in some cases, as we learned this year in the Republican primary. Are there others?
Well, there's good news from New York. The legislature passed a really excellent reform bill, and the governor asked for it, so we're quite sure he's going to sign it.
Well, what else remains if New York becomes more small-D Democratic? What's the next one that you would like to see change?
Florida. Florida is by far the most hostile state in the country for third parties. There hasn't been a third party or independent candidate for governor on the ballot in Florida since 1920. I could just go on and on. One of the most aggravating things about Florida is their filing fees. They're over $10,000 to run for Congress. But if a Democrat or Republican pays the filing fee, the government turns around and gives back over half of it to the Democratic or Republican Party. But if it's any other party, the government keeps all the money.
Don't we run afoul here of federalism if you try to change this? Isn't the Supreme Court going to say, well, look, a state has the right to set its own criteria. That's why we have these states in the first place. Why should we have anything uniform about this?
Well, first of all, Article 1 of the Constitution specifically says that although the states can write election laws, if it's for federal office, Congress can supersede them at any time. And that's why we got the 1993 Voter Registration Act.
So-called motor voter.
Right, which is much more than motor voter. It's postcard registration. And even for state office, the states must follow the First Amendment and the First Amendment. It has freedom of association in it, which really means the freedom to associate into political parties.
Do you think that we're going to see this year, we're already seeing, but do you think it will have any permanent effect, the third-party push that we're seeing, not only, of course, from Ross Perot and his what I consider to be basically a right-wing organization, but also with Ralph Nader, with the new party, with the newly formed Labor Party? Is the proliferation of this, you clearly have studied this over the years, that we see this year likely to lead to some real change in that two-party monopoly?
Things are definitely changing. It's not that we have more third parties than we did in the 70s or 80s, but the kind of people who are interested in third parties have gone from being I hate to call anybody a fringe. I don't like
that. Go ahead. Call me a fringe.
But to get the point across, people with very little power and influence and ability to get attention, now they're people with terrific assets, political assets, reputation, previous experience, interested in third parties, like Governor Weicker running for governor of Connecticut in 1990 as a third-party candidate, now ex-Governor Lamb. Also in 1990, we got a third-party candidate for governor of Alaska, won the election.
And Maine.
And Maine in 1994. And, of course, Bernie Sanders got elected in 1988 to Congress as an independent. and he's been reelected ever since.
So there is some sense of this building. Let me ask you the key question the Pacifica audiences might be interested in knowing. Do you think that this is likely to benefit people on the liberal, progressive to radical side of the spectrum, or is this likely to be more of benefit to those on the conservative and right-wing side of the spectrum?
Well, I think it's going to be of terrific benefit to people on the left side of the spectrum. I think during the 80s, the left interest in third-party activity dwindled down to almost nothing. But that wasn't true on the right, and I don't like to put the Libertarian Party on the right, but people can quibble about that. But set that aside, the Libertarian Party was the most vigorous third party in the United States during the 1980s. It elected state legislators in two states. It aggressively tried to contest every election there was, and definitely politics has moved in a libertarian direction since then, I believe.
Well, what about the parties that would be more on the left side of the spectrum, such as the New Party, for example, such as the Green Party, here the California Peace and Freedom Party, and the possibility that the Labor Party will in the future run candidates? Does it look promising for them, do you think?
Sure. I think they have to learn from the example of the Libertarian Party.
And what is that example?
It pays to go forward with what you believe in. Get out there in front of the public, honestly, say what you believe in. Preach that it's better for people to believe, to vote as they believe. And the results, it does bend politics. It's slow and it's hard to see. But all that third-party activity makes a difference.
Well, another thing that makes a difference is knowing what the laws are, knowing how to get yourself on the ballot. And this is the time, Richard Winger, for you to make your pitch here and let people know how they can get in touch with you if they're interested in getting a copy of Ballot Access News.
Well, if people have pencils, and it's always awkward, who listens to the radio with a pencil in their hand?
Pacifica listeners never drop their pens and pencils.
Okay, phone number is probably the simplest.
Right.
It's in San Francisco, so it's area code 415-922-9779. And if you don't have a talent for numbers, I'm the only Richard Winger in the phone book. Unfortunately, Ballot Access News isn't in the phone book.
Winger is W-I-N-G-E-R. Richard Winger, thank you very much for joining us today on Pacifica. Richard Winger is editor of Ballot Access News and an expert in how to get on the ballot, how to stay on the ballot, and what it means to be on the ballot in the United States. I'm Larry Bensky for Pacifica Radio and Democracy Now!
And Larry, thank you very much for that. Folks, if you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can purchase one from the Pacifica Archives by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And you can send us a line on email. You can send us some email by writing to democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin. Our engineer has been Matthew Finch. Our director, Errol Maitland. Production assistance from Janice K. Bryant, Grayson Challenger, and Zachary Fink. And folks, if you'd like to write to us at Democracy Now!, you can write Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 2009. That's Democracy Now! At Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 2009. And we look forward to hearing from you. Remember, next week, the week after next week, is the Republican Convention, and we'll be there all week broadcasting live 2 hours a day from the San Diego Convention. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!